This is the fifth day of this August 2018 seven-day session. We're going to switch sources now. We've been reading from the teachings of the Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu, and now we're going to dip into another, and this is an anthology called Zen Essence. And this is translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. I've read from this text quite a few times, but not from this section that I'm going to read from now. The first one is from, actually, Zen master Ying An. These are also Chinese masters. Ying An was a disciple of Yuan Wu. He begins, "The mind of Zen practitioners is straight as a bowstring, like a long sword against the sky, cutting through confusion wherever they may be. Worldly wealth and status, nobility and extravagance, mundane desires, and all the ups and downs of life cannot affect them. Fame and profit, judgments of right and wrong, and all the possible states of being cannot trap them." This is quite a tribute to one advanced in Zen practice and enlightened. I'm reminded of what in Buddhism are called the eight winds. These are the eight big potential disturbances of the mind, and they're in pairs, four pairs. One is fame and disrepute. The second pair is censure and praise. Third is gain and loss, and the fourth is pleasure and displeasure. These ten, or these eight winds, go a long way to keeping us off balance in our daily lives until we can live out of that which is beyond these winds. It's a very, very advanced state. So just to take one of them, praise and censure. This is quite a test of anyone's practice to see how she or he responds to praise or to criticism, censure. Most people, 9 out of 10 or 99 out of 100, will flinch from criticism at the very least, flinch, and from praise get a little puffed up. And Ying An here is saying that all these various states cannot trap someone who's advanced enough in Zen practice. This first line, "The mind of Zen practitioners is straight as a bowstring." I'm thinking of the our periodical, Zen Center periodical, Zenbo. Comes from the saying, "The mind of the Zen adept is taut, ready like a drawn bow." Some of the conferences of Zen teachers that I've attended, the annual meetings of the American Zen Teachers Association, I learned that sometimes the bow of Zenbo is understood as bao, Zen bao. That's okay too. continuing with Ying'an, when you pass through, no one can pin you down, no one can call you back. Some people gain an insight and then sit fast on this insight, so their perception is not free. They talk about mystery and marvel, setting forth byways and thinking they are thus helping people. They are destroying Zen. In other words, attachment to whatever insights we have. There's another type of person who cultivates a state of quietude so their bodies and minds feel somewhat light and calm, and then sit frantically in the realm where there are no people. Sit fanatically in the realm where there are no people. This would be a state of attachment to emptiness, a state of emptiness. At this stage of Sesshin, this is a very, very much of a hazard. When the mind becomes relatively free of thoughts, then people can just settle into the quietude of this realm of no thought, which is a pretty nice place to hang out. But it forecloses the possibility of going further, talking especially about people working on a koan. I've often addressed this in Doksan, where people working on a koan, let's say Mu, and they say that they feel very, very deep, quiet place where there are no thoughts, but the Mu is also absent, and what should they do? And I tell them that to break through Mu, you have to have it in your mind. It's tempting when the mind is so clean and pure, empty of thoughts, to just sort of kick Mu to the curb and think, "Right, this is great. I'm just gonna chill here in this realm." And you can. It's nice. It's delicious to float in that realm of no thought. But it's not going to last. It's a conditioned state, meaning it's a state that will pass. It will certainly pass after Sesshin, if not before then. So it's a test. Do I want to just settle into this and coast for the rest of the Sesshin, or do I want to break through this very state itself and go beyond and break through the koan? Actually, for most people, it doesn't even last till the end of Sesshin. It may only last till the end of that block of sitting or the end of that round, and then thoughts come rushing back in, and with them all the afflictions that we deal with in our sitting. He goes on, there are those who get this point of view and then deny everything. There are no Buddhas, no Zen masters, no enlightened ones. They go on denying, doing whatever they want and calling that unobstructed Zen. This is what another ancient master called having a vast realization of emptiness, then trying to deny the effects of causes, becoming wild and unrestrained, bringing on disaster. Yeah, this is a very serious sickness in Zen, where having experienced some stretch of emptiness of mind, you come to convince yourself that nothing matters because everything is empty, that there are no, we can do anything we want, unconcerned with the consequences of what we're doing, because after all, it's all empty. To some people, this may seem rather ridiculous. as it does to me. but when you're in that state, it can seem quite convincing, because you really see the emptiness of all moral systems, the emptiness of the precepts, the emptiness of everything. But it's a sickness because it's only seeing one side of it. There are consequences to our actions. There is this law of causation that we call karma. And to try to convince ourselves otherwise is to be rather deranged. You see this as a rationalization among some unqualified Zen teachers to do whatever they want. It sort of fits also with the Tibetan idea of crazy wisdom. Reminds me of this phrase here, becoming wild and unrestrained, bringing on disaster. Well, recently I talked about this in my last Tei Show at Outside Sesshin, about yet another scandal in American Buddhism with some Tibetan teacher who was indulging in all kinds of misconduct, probably invoking the idea of crazy wisdom. But this is a sure way to create suffering for others as well as for oneself. There's something Bodhidharma said, let's see if I can pull it out of my brain. Those who think that there is only emptiness, condemn themselves to pitch black everlasting hell, something like that. Or in a more sort of philosophical vein, what we chant in the Prajnaparamita, we say, form is only emptiness. Okay, these rogue teachers would sign off on that. Form is only emptiness. That is, all structures, all morality is only emptiness. But what's the second half? Emptiness, only form. Emptiness, as it expresses itself in the world of phenomena, that includes the precepts, that includes karma, causation, pain. He's targeting various types in his, probably in his monastery, who he needs to tag. There is also a type whose point of view is oblivious silence, not hearing anything. After they have eaten of the Sangha's food, they just sit there as if dead, waiting for enlightenment. People like this are clumps of clay in ramshackle huts in the deep mountains and broad wastelands. They might think they are Buddhist masters with unchanging wisdom, but they are just using up the donations of the faithful. Another one here by Ying An. The beginning of cultivating yourself, we could say that really means practice, the beginning of practice, is right in yourself. On a 1,000-mile journey, the first step is the most important. If you can do both of these well, the infinite, sublime meanings of hundreds of thousands of teachings will be fulfilled. Roshi Kaplow used to end every introductory workshop with this Chinese saying. The way he would say it is, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And it hit my own workshop, my first day ever at the Zen Center. This hit me with tremendous force. And even after that, in the other workshops where I would assist him, each time it would give me the chills with excitement at the possibility that these people being introduced to the Dharma could adopt this path and follow it, maybe for years. Here's a short one. Zen has nothing to grab onto. When people who practice Zen don't see it, that is because they approach too eagerly. Always we have to be wary about translations. And that's why there's some room for interpretation. I would see this word eagerly, meaning they are too grasping, or too greedy for some kind of attainment. There is nothing. Oh, he says that Zen has nothing to grab onto. I remember when working on Mu, feeling that all of my attempts to get a hold of it, I was frustrated by how it kept getting away from me, and seemed like trying to take hold of a wet bar of soap. The problem there is trying to take hold of it rather than just sinking into it or absorbing oneself into it. Rather than trying to get your arms around it, become it. There's a difference. Become Mu. Fuse with it. Merge with it. Sink into it. He continues, if you want to understand Zen easily, just be no-minded, wherever you are, 24 hours a day, until you spontaneously merge with the way. No-mind, of course, means free of thoughts, unnecessary thoughts. Once you merge with the way, inside, outside, or in between cannot be found at all. You experience a frozen emptiness, totally independent. Doesn't sound like any resting point to be the word frozen. The emptiness should be alive, vital, fluid, active, free, not frozen. First of all, don't establish a preconceived understanding of Zen, yet don't rationalize Zen as not understanding either. Preconceived understanding of Zen is a big hurdle that we have to contend with when we first come to Zen practice. Most people have all these ideas about what it is, what it isn't, and how they should be, how they should act, what a Zen teacher is like, and so forth. It can take a long time to scour away these ideas. It's just like learning archery. Eventually you reach a point where ideas are ended and feelings forgotten, and then you suddenly hit the target. ideas are ended and feelings forgotten. Not feelings gotten rid of or suppressed, just forgotten, not clinging to feelings. I often make this point because that's one of the preconceived ideas about Zen that people can have, is that if you're really advanced in Zen practice, then you're beyond feeling, beyond emotions. And it's just nonsense. As long as we have bodies with hormonal systems, we're going to have feelings and emotions. Don't need to be a problem as long as we don't dwell in them, wallow in them. And so I think this is a good translation. Feelings forgotten. Let them run their course. They may take a longer time, may take a shorter time, but we don't want to obstruct them by clinging to them or by trying to suppress them. That's another way of getting caught in them. Another, just let go of the burden of others and self, of ideas of gain and loss, right and wrong, Buddha and Buddhism, mystery and marvel. Well, these are big ideas that can cause a lot of problems. But they're about a millionth of a percent of all the ideas that we can get snared in. Others and self are the big ones. Gain and loss, right and wrong is huge. Buddha and Buddhism, that blocked me for a while, my early years, where I didn't fancy myself as religious in any way and didn't cotton to the idea that I would be a Buddhist. Okay, don't think of yourself as a Buddhist, but practice the Dharma. Practice this practice. Another teacher, actually some kind of Buddhist teacher, Vipassana maybe it was Jack Kornfeld, who said that his students found that going home, visiting their family, they got in trouble if they're trying to be Buddhist, but if they were just a Buddha, then everything was fine. Point being, free of any notions, any attachments of self-identity. As soon as you let go this way, you feel body and mind light and easy, thoroughly pure inside and out. Then your heart is clear all the time. In a cool flash of insight, you go free. Your body and mind light and easy. This is a state of samadhi, absolute oneness to the point of self-forgetfulness. Oneness with the practice to the point of self-forgetfulness. Another one, if mature people want to cut off the road of birth and death, they should relinquish what they have been holding dear so that their senses become clean and naked. One day they will gain insight and the road of birth and death is sure to end. Relinquish what they've been holding dear could mean many things, but most importantly, relinquishing our cherished opinions, notions, biases, but again, we don't have to think, make that a project. Okay, I'm going to relinquish my opinions and ideas. It just happens on its own through devoted practice. That's the wonderful thing. If we made it a project, then we'd be setting up something in the mind that we have to get rid of eventually. We don't have to work this out, figure it out, and lay out a 10-point plan of how we're going to do these things. We just have to completely give ourselves to the practice we're working on, and it happens by itself. The practice will do it for us. And he says, if you don't practice this in reality, but desire a lot of intellectual knowledge, thinking this is the wonder of self-realization, your chills and fever will be increased by the wind of intellectual knowledge. Your nose will always be stuffy and your head will always be foggy. It's a pretty good metaphorical way of capturing a state where we're dwelling in thoughts, caught in a cloud of thoughts. Your nose will always be stuffy and your head will always be foggy. Of course, we realize what a fog we are in most of the time only when we finally get out of it. When we see the difference between direct experience and thoughts, night and day. It's another one. If people want to learn Zen, let them learn the Zen of a lone lamp shining in a death ward. So what comes to mind is the word vigil. We need to be vigilant all the time in Zen practice. Mindful, really. Quick to notice how the mind deceives us, how the mind captures us, takes us away. How the mind clouds this immediate, direct experience. Vigilant. Here's another one among these miscellaneous teachings. He says, the ancient Zen masters did not have a single thought of trying to become great people. Only thus did they attain mastery of life and death, and after that, greatness came of itself. If you have a single thought of eagerness to attain Zen mastery, this burns out your potential so you cannot grow anymore. Well, just the basic thing of setting up a goal, having an image of something that you want to become, this is a sure way to handicap yourself. And as I said in one of the first Teishos this week, the danger of being having the ambition of becoming a teacher. not that it's any kind of deal breaker. In my first couple years of Zen practice, that was something I was hungering for, to someday be a great Zen master. But it has to go. It gets scoured away. It's just a dream, an image. And then, in that respect, this next one sentence, he says, the classical masters of Zen were people who had above all let go. People who had above all let go. That's one of the ways we can sort of sum up Zen practice. There are a bunch of them, but that's a good one. Letting go. Letting go. That's what, this is all a practice of letting go. Letting go is the secret to living, being present, secret to dying. I'm plucking out a few things here. They did not associate with people at random, and they did not dwell on anything ephemeral. Did not associate with people at random. I think the point we can draw from that is that we have to be aware that we are affected by the people we associate with. They influence us, for better or for worse. This is why being part of a sangha can be so helpful. Having a teacher in Southeast Asian Buddhism, instead of teacher, they often use the phrase a spiritual friend. Rather than associating with people at random. Here's another one. Generally speaking, Zen requires a decisive, powerful will because you are going to be cleaning your six senses all the time, so that even if you are in the midst of all the stresses and pleasures of the world, it is like being in a pure, uncontrived realm of great liberation. Yeah, here too, another advanced state we can aspire to. Is that, again, the Japanese word joriki, this special power, force of mind that comes as a result of concentration. This is what builds over the course of 7 days of sitting, where we generate this coiled energy within ourselves. It's how it's even possible to go for a whole week without sleep. This is reference to this morning's, when I talked this morning about new monks in Japan. Aren't allowed to lie down for 7 days. The only way that's possible is through the sitting, because in the sitting we are conserving so much energy. We are through this focused energy of concentration. We build up this reservoir of energy. This is why After Sesshin, we come out of Sesshin, we're tired. Yes, we're tired because of all the effort we've been making, but we're also wired. Wired and tired at the same time. it takes energy, joriki, to pull free of the tug of thoughts. Thoughts that are tugging at us all the time. We have to have the will, as he says, the will to refrain from pursuing thoughts when we notice that we've fallen into them. But then the other side of will is at some point we have to go beyond will, because will usually means a sense of control, which is ultimately illusory. We have to give up this idea that we can control everything. We have to graduate from strong will to offering us up, yielding to what is more than will, this great mind that we all share. Will serves us well for a long time. It can keep us focused, keep us from squandering time, but then at a certain point it is superseded by this self nature of ours. And then he describes profoundly stable and calm, like a gigantic mountain. You cannot be disturbed by cravings or external conditions. You cannot be held back by interference and difficulty. So this kind of will is what we would need if we're associating with the wrong people, not to be drawn into their misconduct, or not being drawn into temptations that we know are unhealthy. I'm thinking of Takahatsu. When we do this, the Takahatsu of picking up litter in the neighborhood, those of us on staff at the center, we're surrounded by worldly distractions. And we have to maintain this focus to slice through all those things that could turn our heads, turn us this way or that. Well, that's a rather innocuous way of contending with distractions. More important is when we are facing the temptation of breaking one of the precepts, of especially the first five precepts, or I'm thinking of alcohol or drugs or sexual misconduct, of lying. These things, we have to be able to refrain from doing. Let's read one entry in this anthology under Zen Master Mian. We're still in the 12th century, more or less. He says, the shortcut of Zen is to leave the present and directly experience the state before birth, before the division of wholeness. Now here's where words can be confusing, is to leave the present. By that, What he means is the present conditions, to transcend present conditions and see what is beyond conditions, the state before birth, before the division of wholeness, before self and other, us and them, right and wrong, and all the other dualisms. When you accomplish this, you are like a dragon in the water, like a tiger in the mountains. You are very clear and calm everywhere, free to enliven or kill everywhere, spontaneously able to rouse the wind and stir the grasses everywhere. You do not cling to any activity. You do not sit inactive. This is like cutting a skein of thread and dying a skein of thread. When one is cut, all are cut. When one is dyed, all are dyed. From top to bottom, the whole thing is a huge door of liberation. Now the Dharma and things of the world have become one. Where is there any external thing at all to constitute an impediment? This image of the thread, when one is cut, they all are. One is dyed, they all are. Because there is just this one mind. All right. Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.